The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Symposium of the Lotus Eaters. Today we're joined by Josh and Carl.
Hello.
And we are going to talk about Sun Tzu's The Art of War, which is one of the fundamental texts of military wisdom and military advice, but it is surprisingly applicable to many other areas in life because fundamentally you could say life is conflict or it involves a great bit of conflict. I'm sure you like the reference and that you agree with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's true.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
It's a sort of similar approach that we took to The Book of Five Rings, which, funnily enough, I have right next to me. And even though it's explicitly about the way of the blade, if you will, there are lots of lessons that you can learn from it, just principles which not only apply to combat and conflict, but also to just living a good life. And actually, lots of the principles for excellence in mastering certain weapons apply just as much as stated in the book, to things like carpentry or other professions. He's saying that there is a correct way of operating, and I think that there's a similar undercurrent running through Sun Tzu as well, and I think there's a lot of Taoism in there as well, which I'm sure we'll get to eventually.
I think we will, and I think it is really interesting to note that a lot of texts that are about military wisdom, just like the Book of Five Rings, as you said, or about martial arts, they are applicable in more than that, in more than this, in more than that, let's say, level. Because there are many people who read them, like business leaders, people in all sorts of, in politics, as we mentioned before, but also people who care about self-improvement, because you could fundamentally describe almost everything as a battle. Even something so, let's say, relatively innocuous as going to the gym, you could describe it as a battle between two sides, and there is a kind of context there that makes these sayings really applicable.
I remember covering some clinical psychology on depression, and they talked about the battle of waking up in the morning, just getting out of bed. For some people is a battle which they sometimes don't see victory. So it's always very contextual to the individual in question as to what they consider the point of conflict. But it's one of those things that it could apply relatively universally because no one is completely, no one avoids suffering and conflict.
It's a struggle of opening your eyes in the morning, especially, yes. And there are all sorts of interesting things that we'll go there in a minute. But let us just say that this is a text that has been written by supposedly a legendary figure. There is a scholarly debate as to whether Sun Tzu was one person or more, or whether he even existed. And whether the text, as we know it now, has sort of changed through time, and whether it involves lots of commentary. Because I have an edition with a translation by Thomas Cleary. He is a very big figure in translating Eastern texts. I think he has translated close to 80. And he has this translation, and he has a lot of the commentary with it of mm-hmm. other generals they were saying, and they were analyzing each quote.
Yeah.
It's also not an easy thing to do because ancient Chinese is significantly different, and because it's a language form in which the characters have a very specific cultural context that might be lost over time, the actual meanings attached to certain characters may be impossible to decipher because, as we've covered before in lots of other Eastern philosophy, the characters tend to have all of these different connotations. It has a sort of dictionary definition, if you will, but then there'll be all of these other concepts that might be far less intuitive attached to them. And sometimes it can be a little bit difficult to capture that in English because each character, each word, if you will, is rich with a wealth of meaning and associations that you might not have with, say, an English word.
And you mentioned before in our contemplations we did the difference between a language like Chinese, ancient Chinese, that has the symbolic ideograms, and the phonetic languages that are in a lot of the Western world.
Mm-hmm.
That there is a sort of a depiction of something with
yes.
the characters and the but ideograms.
But it also changes the purpose of the writing itself. Like
yeah.
writing in ancient Chinese, it's more tied into this philosophy of mindfulness and meditation. Therefore, they'll, you know, as with the Tao Te Ching, they'll deliberately write in contradictions as a test for someone who they know will be sitting and thinking and meditating about it, whereas the tendency in the West is to just state explicitly what you mean and just expect people to follow it to the letter, okay. rather than to try and think through something and make it sort of their own. I kind of like the idea of setting someone on a path and not necessarily telling them the destination, even if you know what it is, because there's a lot of wisdom in the fact that you can tell someone what is right, the right thing to do, but until they've got some sort of personal experience, they don't have an understanding. It's a sort of soap impression of reality, and I think that experience is the sort of gold standard for which truth should be tested, and that approach, I think, is more consistent with that mindset.
So a lot has been said about the Taoist element of this book. So, Josh, you're, in a sense, expert for Eastern philosophy. Would you say that this is accurate?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So The Art of War was written about 100 years before this is obviously estimating because we don't know the exact publication
yeah.
dates, and to even look at it in that way is a bit anachronistic because
yeah.
it wasn't like they had printing presses and, you know, they were flying off the shelves. So it might have, you know, been written and it took a while to circulate. But you can see the fingerprints, if you will, of Taoism all throughout The Art of War. For example, he even explicitly says, you need to embody the qualities of water, and he's talking about it in the sense of adaptability. And I actually have a chapter I'd like to read from the Tao Te Ching, which talks about exactly that. And it's pretty explicit as to the virtues of water. It says, people of the highest virtue are like water. Water benefits creation without any conflict, and it favors the low places shunned by the common people. In this, it resembles the Tao. Live in harmony with the land, allow emotions to run deep, show benevolence in your dealings with others, speak with honesty, arrange things according to the proper order, manage according to your ability, act according to opportunity. Without conflict, there is no animosity. And obviously, you can see the applicability of that in warfare.
Yeah.
But I find it very interesting that we know that the Art of War came before by about 100 years, maybe less, maybe a little bit more, but on average.
Okay.
And so that indicates that actually these ideas in the Tao Te Ching were simply a formalization of ideas that were already well established in ancient Chinese society. We're talking, you know, 500 BC, around this sort of time, maybe even 600 BC, depending on where we look. But it's interesting to me that it presages the sort of formalization of the key Taoist text, and yet does so in a way that you could almost think, if you didn't know when each were published, that the Art of War came afterwards rather than before, because there's such similarity between the two.
I'm going to be very controversial. I don't think that it's a very abstract text at all, and I think that actually we're bringing to it something that isn't necessarily contained within it. For example, in The Art of War, when he says to be like water, what he's saying is don't be rigid, because The Art of War is a very practical book, and it's very directly about military tactics. Mm-hmm. It's explicitly about military tactics and about the management of armies in the field and before, and how to fight and win battles. And so when we imprint upon it this kind of... I mean, it, obviously, it is from the cultural context that produced the Tao, right? So that is true. But in that specific quote, he's being contextual, and contextually he's saying that if you are essentially rigid and you stick to the same tactics, then your enemies will learn them and destroy you with them. And so when he's saying you've got to flow like water, he's not appealing to some sort of abstract philosophical concept. He's saying you have to adapt to the circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, and I'm not saying you're wrong, obviously.
But of course.
What I'm saying is, like, on a much more immediate level, like, he's saying in a specific metaphorical way to make sure that the general he's advising understands that essentially the context is always king, the contingent is always the king on the battlefield, because a lot of people will approach any subject, but especially war, when we're that's so dangerous, with quite rigid mindsets and a lot of preconceptions that may or may not hold up. So you've got to, you know, move with the terrain, but it's not on. He's not appealing to a broader personal or philosophical position. He's saying, no, in the immediate, people will die if you don't adapt to circumstance.
I do agree with that, and I think it's actually important to talk about the tone of the text and how it differs from a lot of the other texts of the time. Because one thing that you can certainly notice about it is that it doesn't mince words, does it?
No,
it's pretty totally stark and explicit.
Yeah.
And my point in bringing up the water aspect is simply that I found it interesting that it's circulating.
And I'm not saying it's not there. And I'm not saying it doesn't come from that cultural context. And you are, of course, right that, you know, the paradigm of ideas is the same and is obviously stretched back. And, you know, the Art of War was probably a collection of oral advice that got formalized into a text, as most ancient texts are. And so that is true, but, like, I think that you make a good point there, that, like, the remarkable thing about the Art of War is it feels like a Western text.
It does, yeah.
And it's because it's very low to the ground, and it's very direct, and you're completely right. In the West, we've got very straightforward and sort of firm, logical ways of connecting ideas. You know, there's nothing like in the Tao where it's like, well, this is the mystery between things that we're talking about. There's nothing like that in the West, because we're very empirical and pragmatic. And so Sun Tzu feels like he could have been writing in, you know, first century Rome. You know, this is like Morris's Strategicon or something like that. You know, it's like, no, you must do this, you must do that, you must do the other, or else you lose.
I think that's part of the reason why people still read it to this day, is that it's aged so well, because it's taking that very practical look at things. And you can obviously understand why he's doing it. It almost seems obvious to state it, but it's that it's life or death. You know, when it comes to philosophy and things like that, it makes sense that they're trying to communicate all of the nuances, and they don't want to be too forceful with pushing a single idea in the case that it's wrong and it's misrepresented, because, you know, in the Tao Te Ching, there's an understanding of the limitation of the human perspective to understand the truth of things. And that's certainly present in The Art of War, but in a much more practical framing, in that you can be mistaken about the things in which you may have been taught. You've always got to be vigilant as to, you know, whether you've been mistaken and been misled, because, as he says, deception is an essential part of warfare.
Well, and so, all warfare is based on deception.
Yes, exactly.
Which is interesting.
I don't know why I butchered that quote when it's so...
It's such a classic.
It is,
yeah. And it's right at the beginning as well. Mm-hmm. And what I love about Sun Tzu is he's just... Like you said, he's not mincing words. He's like, look, I know you don't know. These are the things you need to be thinking about, and this is what you have to do. And it's just... There's not even any debate about it. And this is why everyone... It's a common critique of Sun Tzu, say, oh, these are just obvious things, aren't they? And it's like, no, actually they're not. Because actually when you're managing 100,000 fighting men, a lot of things that seem obvious when you're sat on your sofa looking at your screen of Rome Total War are actually not obvious at all, right? And this is my main point about The Art of War, is it's about mindfulness, really, in the base of it, because when you are in a position where you have a certain number of things and people that you have to manage, it's very easy to become sort of myopic and solipsistic about this and say, right, okay, we've done these things. And Sun Tzu is saying, no, you have to be aware of the entire board and everything in it, and also of the perspective of the person on the other side. So when he is drawing your attention to, are the men well rested? Are the men things? I mean, these are remedial things, but you have to keep them in your mind while you're also thinking about, you know, is that a good place to put my men? What are his men like? You know, does he know about my positions? Do I know about his positions? And so you've got to juggle all of these things. And so him listing them all isn't him being simplistic. It's him making present in your thoughts all of the various factors that will affect your chances of victory.
I think it also serves a very important metacognitive purpose, in that he's, by demonstrating quite clear points, if you will, you know, the generals he's writing for is a sort of instructional manual.
Yeah.
They'll be aware of these concepts and probably well acquainted with some of them at least, but hearing someone who has a certain level of mastery, which is self-evident from the text, I think, seeing how all of the ideas tie together and how he actually approaches and thinks about these concepts and how methodical you can be about it, demonstrating that thought process is kind of one of the important things, I think, because one of the themes I picked up on running through the text is that you've got to be cognizant of all factors at all times. Yeah. You know, he doesn't explicitly say that, but that's the effect of the text. Yeah, yeah. It seems to be implicit in the text, and it seems to be one of the key things which you can take away from it, is that actually it's very, very complicated to be a general.
I mean,
you don't necessarily need to have read history to know that, but you can at least gather that much from the text, which is quite short as well. That they had to consider a lot, and it gives you a certain amount of respect for the profession, if you will, although I was already quite respectful of it to begin with.
Yeah.
But it certainly highlights a standard that is expected as well, and I think that part of the reason that the text exists is likely that it was potentially commissioned to set a standard, and therefore it makes sense that it's trying to set out to say, this is what you must do, because it's quite commanding, if you will, which makes sense.
Yeah, no, it's explicit.
Mm.
I want to say something, because I think that in a way it is philosophical. It is simultaneously explicit, but there is also rich metaphor. For instance, when he says, for the impact of armed forces to be like stones thrown on eggs is a matter of emptiness and fullness. This isn't exactly explicit, and there seems to be a philosophical underpinning. But I think that when we're talking about philosophical underpinning, we don't talk about rich metaphysical aspect of it, like saying like the one being and how the second level in the great chain of being follows from the one and emanates. I think it has to do with pure wisdom. Just like be in the moment, judge the situation correctly, read the room, read the conditions of the battlefield. And water represents a sort of liquidity and a sort of flux.
Yeah.
And there is a message that the conditions of the battlefield could change any moment. So if you're too rigid, as you say, you're not going to read the room correctly. Yeah. You're going to be stuck with in your own mind, as opposed to being in that condition of emptiness that is, I think, a metaphor for saying eliminate the subjective aspect of it, as you said, the rigidity coming from the inner sense, and just read the situation and do the right thing.
Yeah. One of the points that when you take away from the overarching text is you have to have a plan.
Yes.
You have to know all of the situations in advance, and then you have to have prudent judgment of what's actually happening. So your plan and yourself can be flexible to deal with events as they evolve order to secure victory.
Yes. And let me just say the last quote from the first chapter. I quote from the translation of Thomas Cleary. That's the translation I'm going to use. Sun Tzu says, "The one who figures on victory at headquarters before even doing battle is the one who has the most strategic factors on his side. The one who figures inability to prevail at headquarters before doing battle is the one who has the least strategic factors on his side. The one with many strategic factors in his favor wins. The one with a few strategic factors in his favor loses. How much more so for one with no strategic factors in his favor? Observing the matter in this way, I can see who will win and who will lose."
Yes.
I think this is a very pithy way of saying what you said before, that he focuses on intelligence, on knowledge of the battlefield, and also self-knowledge, knowledge of the army, and
Well, this is something that's really well attested throughout military history as well, to be honest.
Yeah.
The classic example of this is Hannibal. Hannibal had obviously spent a lot of time planning his campaign, and I can't remember exactly the formulation. I suppose it depends on translation. But if you know yourself and the enemy, then you'll never lose in 100 battles, something like that. Right?
Yeah, that's from Sun Tzu.
And that's completely true. And this is really well attested, because one of the things that Hannibal was famous for is being interested, excessively interested, it seemed, in the character of the Roman generals he was fighting. This is what he would be most interested in, rather than the dispositions of their troops and things like that.
Yes.
Because that's all sort of secondary knowledge. Because Hannibal's goal and Hannibal's strategy was to psychologically outplay the enemy. And that's what Sun Tzu advises all the way through the book.
Yes.
You know, you've got to know why your opponent does this, and you've got to engage in a kind of psychological warfare, and that's why all warfare is based on deception. And I mean, Hannibal's just such a great example of this. The Battle of Lake Trasimene is such a great example of this, because Hannibal hides all of his forces just behind the ridge of a hill and conducts probably the largest ambush in all of history and wipes out a Roman army with barely any casualties to himself. And this was only possible because he knew the mindset of the Romans themselves and the Roman commander at the time. And the same with the Battle of Cannae as well. He knew that Varro was a very headstrong person, and he knew this because he sent spies out and he gathered all this information. And Paulus was very conservative, Varro was very aggressive. And so he would just propose the battle on the day that Varro is there, and Varro couldn't resist. And of course, this leads them into the grand trap of Cannae and gets their army annihilated. And so Sun Tzu is correct on all of these things. And and Hannibal's just the most easy example. There are other good examples of these, but that's just the most easy.
Let me just say about the Battle of Cannae. Was it not the case that the Roman consuls were switching on a daily basis the leadership, which in a sense spread a kind of confusion to the soldiers and also led Hannibal into take advantage of and position his army much better than the Romans, because is it not the case that the kind of strategy that one console was pushing forward was in a sense undone by the other console the next day?
Well, Paulus's strategy was to not engage in a giant battle with Hannibal, whereas Varro was like, look, we're just going to raise the largest army we've ever had and then just steamroll him. But Hannibal had learned from his previous experience of fighting the Romans. And so you can tell that Hannibal had very, very well thought out how he was going to annihilate them in this great battle, because the Romans have a very strong forward punch. But that was pretty much about it at the time. And so Hannibal just made it so that his line could retreat a great distance, and the Romans would just go straight into it, and then they found themselves just totally enveloped on the field. That he learned that from the Trebia, because the Roman he formed a solid line, and the Romans punched through it, but he still managed to win. And so he was essentially he created a great deal of like flexibility in his own army to absorb. The Roman punch, and the Romans didn't spend any amount of time thinking about Hannibal or his army. They just were like, well, we're just strong, so we're just going to go forward, aren't we? But Hannibal had clearly thought about this in advance when he laid out his dispositions. And it never crossed the Roman mind, hang on a second, there's something happening here that we're not aware of. Why is he like that? You know, who is this guy? What are we, you know, they were just like, oh, he's a barbarian, we're just going to kill him. And they got them totally destroyed. So, anyway, it's
interesting, because this is a brilliant illustration of some of the maxims of Sun Tzu, like know yourself and your enemy, know the battlefield, know the strategy. But also he talks explicitly about the faults of generals, and he says that, for instance, when some generals are too proud and they can be lured into a trap if the enemy appeals to their sentiment of honor.
And not just that, it's not just honor as well. It's I guess some sort of arrogance. Because, I mean, at Cannae was a trap, but it was on open ground, with nothing hidden, and with no surprises, right? So, and even, you know, a great general is capable of creating a trap in the open with nothing available. And Sun Tzu would have definitely had a lot to say about the Battle of Cannae as well. Because it, on Hannibal's side, it follows many of his maxims. On the Roman side, it violates almost all of them.
I like the framing that Sun Tzu has here, because I think it deliberately puts the onus on the individual general as to the success or failure of a battle. He's trying to say, well, these external factors are to be understood by you. You can't say, oh, well, you know, the sun was not in our favour, and you can't blame other things. It's ultimately up to you to understand things, and the reason that people win and others lose is that the person who won was a better strategist. Things were in their favour. And so I think that the nature of the text, he's kind of reminding them that this is your failure, you need to own it, and therefore you need to be better. And that's quite important, because when you're dealing with something as complicated as a military campaign, the tendency might be to say, well, this is very, very complicated. I had to overlook a lot of things. I did lots very well, but this unforeseen factor scuppered my campaign, and therefore, you know, I did my best. I wash my hands clean of the failure, but...
Yeah, that's not good enough.
Yeah.
Man died, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I think that he's trying to make people, well, generals specifically, far more focused on their role, and actually it's a game of understanding the world around you, understanding how you interact with it, and understanding your enemy.
And understanding cause and effect as well.
Exactly.
This is why people are contemptuous of his. You know, if you're in marshy ground, find a copse of trees and put them at your back. If you're on level ground, find a slope and put that at your back, and things like this. Put your men on the high ground, make sure you march during the day, all these sorts of things. But they're not, when taken in totality, actually, you could easily forget these things, or you could think, well, maybe I can just risk it this time. Like when he's saying, don't force march your men 100 li, because hardly any of them will get there, and when they get there, they'll be useless. You know, don't march them 50 li, because then, a tenth of your men will be useless. When you march them 50 li, only half of them will be useful. You know, when you march them 30 li, you'll lose a third of your army. Things like this. Like, these things are important, and they are literally, like, a campaign can hinge on these things.
Mm-hmm. But these sort of simple factors, I think he's making it implicit that there is a correct way of doing things. Oh, yeah. There is a way that is better than other ways, not always created equal.
Absolutely.
And therefore, yeah. he's trying to say, have a sort of objective read of the situation, try and adapt yourself to that situation, and you will succeed. And that, although he may not state that explicitly every time, he says it explicitly once or twice throughout the text, doesn't he?
And it's the general theme of the text.
It is,
well. I know what I'm doing, you don't know what you're doing. Do it this way or you die.
I think this is a very prevalent feature of wisdom literature across the board, not just military wisdom, because it is the, you know, I know, you don't know, I'm teaching you.
Yes.
And it is it is meant to be simple. I don't think it's simplistic to say stuff that we may think to be self-evident. We may take as self-evident because I want to ask you one question. How many times are we making self-evident mistakes?
Constantly. Yeah.
We're constantly making self-evident mistakes. So I think that one of the goals of wisdom literature in general is to resist the natural tendency of forgetting a lot of things and bear the whole in mind and do what we are doing, engage in every task while bearing the whole in mind. Because we very frequently do mistakes that are unbelievably simple.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
The World Cup Championship will be crowned this week, and you can trade the tourney through the finals on Kalshi, America's number one prediction market platform. Right now, Spain is trading at 58% to beat Argentina, meaning 100 trade pays out 166 if they win. On Kalshi, you're trading against other people in a live market. No house, no odds makers. For a limited time, download the Kalshi app and use code DEFEND to get $10 when you trade $10. K-A-L-S-H-I. Kalshi. Trade the beautiful game. 18 plus only. Restrictions and eligibility requirements apply. Event contract trading involves risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Kalshi products are not available in all jurisdictions. Prices, values, and available markets may differ from those mentioned. For more information, see kalshi.com/regulatory.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
The Sherwin-Williams Summer Sale is here. Get 30% off select paints and stains or 35% off our newest product, Emerald Symmetry, July 17th through the 27th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.